The merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe, peace and blessings upon his servant and Messenger Muhammad forever. Amen. I greet you with a greeting that is common, a greeting in Islam, Assalamu Alaikum, which means peace be unto you. Today we have our 13th program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion of the topic of prohibition of interest in Islam. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me as usual Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Louis University. Brother Jamal, Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
This is customary whenever we begin a new episode of Islamic Focus. We always take a few minutes to summarize the main points that we touched on in our previous program. Could I ask you perhaps just to summarize the main points when we began this discussion of prohibition of interest in Islam?
Okay. Well, the previous program was a continuation of the broad topic of production and productivity in Islam. And after having gone through so many programs indicating Muslim attitudes towards science and technology, we touched on some of the specific measures in an ideal economic system in Islam where there is a great deal of incentives or inducements for productivity. And we said that this could be done in a variety of ways. We gave three examples, or at least mentioned three. One is the question of land use, and we indicated again how Islam encourages reformation of land and use of it, and making as a condition for keeping this land to make it productive and useful for the community at large. Secondly, we discussed also the prohibition of interest in Islam as one of the things which induce productivity rather than curtail it, really. But we started first by saying that it is a myth to consider interest as a precondition for having any advanced economic system. And we started looking at it first from the Islamic law point of view. That is how it is clearly and unequivocally forbidden to the Muslim in the Quran, the word of God as believed by Muslim, and the prophetic tradition. We indicated that Islam was not the only faith which prohibited interest or usury, as the old name used to be. We also indicated that this prohibition is not restricted only to excessive interest, but any interest, small or large, is forbidden. We indicated again what the Quran indicates as the false comparison or analogy people make between trade and interest, and indicated again why these are not exactly the same thing. And finally, we said that the prohibition is not only in the matter of consumption loans, but even production loans, because this kind of interest was known already when this verses were revealed in the Quran, not only consumer loans, but productive loans.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to begin today's program if I could first ask you to give us some information on the types of interest that were prevalent in pre-Islamic days.
Well, Muslim jurists and historians divide them into two broad categories. One category of interest dealing, quote-unquote, that was prominent among the men of the pre-Islamic days is called al-Nasi'ah, riba al-Nasi'ah, which means basically, as explained by Ahmad and Fakhr al-Razi, is somebody lending you an amount of money for a given term. Mm-hmm. And then when the term comes and you're not able to pay, he says, all right, I'll delay your loan for another year, but you have to pay me X amount extra, 10% more, 15% or whatever other amount. A similar form also is used that in buying and selling. Like, I sell you one item and say, all right, it's worth $1,000. Now, you don't pay it in the specified time. Then I come back and say, all right, you can delay your payment for a few more months, but you have to pay me 10% extra. This one, or this type of interest is clearly and unequivocally, there's no question at all about it's been prohibited in Islam. The second major category, they call it riba al-biyu', or something which relates to the exchange of commodities or buying and selling. It's a specific type. And even there, we find subcategories, but without getting into technicalities, perhaps the most objectionable type, which gets very analogous to the first absolutely prohibited, is the case where you exchange one commodity for the other.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I give you, for example, so many bushels of wheat now, and ask you to return it back to me after a certain period of time, but you have to return it more. Assuming, again, we're talking about the same policy. So if I give you 10 bushels, but you have to give me 11 bushels. Now, this has led to a little bit of confusion in the minds of some jurists. Some of them said that does not seem as clear-cut case as the lending of money. Some even refer to a saying of the Prophet where it seems to emphasize more on the first type of usury or interest, but not this one. To some, but not to many few, including Ibn Abbas, one of the early jurists, said that it is not exactly or clearly forbidden as the first one. However, the great majority of Muslim Jews feel that there is not much substantive difference really between the two. Because, as the Prophet indicated in one saying narrated in Bukhari and Muslim, when we talk about exchange of commodities, he indicated and insisted that it should be equal, and anyone who asks for more, he is really committing riba or really asking for what is equivalent to interest, which is forbidden in Islam. The other reason why I feel that the majority opinion seems to be really more than justified is that if you open the door and say this is permissible and this is not permissible, people will find a back door around the law. Example. If you wanted to avoid the straight interest and you want to borrow $1,000 from me, all I can do to beat the system is to buy 2 ounces of gold, let's say for this $1,000. I'll give you 2 ounces of gold and say, here is my loan to you, but when you pay it back, you pay it 2.5 ounces. It's just playing tricks, really. Instead of lending you money, I'm giving you gold, but asking for more gold later on. That's why the Prophet says exchange must be of the same amount if it's the same type of quality, or else it's just a backdoor. Of course, this assumes talking about things which are of the same quality. The question perhaps may arise, if you want to exchange some commodity of different quality,
mm-hmm.
I have a better grade of wheat, you have a lesser grade of wheat. When we exchange these commodities, what will happen? The solution is clear, as the Prophet, peace be upon him, recommends. That is, to avoid any doubt in mind, to avoid any back door, the best way would be to sell. If you need the money, I'll sell the good quality wheat that I have. Alright? And give you the money, and then when you return the money without any increase, you can return it in the form of wheat of a different quality. But again, money here, or the currency, would be used as a medium of exchange to achieve justice and equity and not really to loop the system.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, there are some who would suggest that among some jurors, there are those who would take a more lenient view in terms of their attitude towards interest. Can you perhaps clarify for us the basis of some of these claims that that there are more a case for more lenient interpretation of the policy?
Okay. Well, first of all, I would not discuss the question from the vantage point of raising any issue about political affiliation or political pressures on some jurors to give up to give the verdict that their particular oppressive government may be demanding from them or pressing them. If this might be the case in very rare situations, it may exist. I'm not totally eliminating, but I'm not even discussing on that basis, because that's an easy way to go out and not discuss the things more objectively. But I would say, even if you assume good intention and lack of pressure, I think, as Prophet Muhammad indicated, that my ummah or my followers will never have a unanimous view on something which is wrong. So there may be some humans who may slip or make a mistake here, or there, even with good intention, but never the majority or the consensus of Muslim Jews. And the consensus is that it is forbidden. So we have to look at it only as isolated cases. But some of the reasons why this kind of attitude or lenient attitude was taken may be explained by the fact that some jurists may be very well trained in Islamic law as such in Islamic teaching, but they may lack reasonable understanding of economics and how Islamic system operates.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to a jurist like that who doesn't have this background and you tell him that it isn't possible for our country to progress and have development if we were to follow strictly the rules about interest, and if you get the impression that it is impossible to have the means of living and support the development without interest, they may give a rule in the Islamic law which says when you're really forced, not by choice, you may resort to that. But that assumption is wrong in itself. Let's discuss even some of the basic grounds that people use for this justification. Mm-hmm. And this was all discussed by Sheikh Abu Zahra in response or rebuttal to this. As I indicated earlier, some might use the rule of necessity. But again, there is no reason on earth why interest would be an absolute necessity without which you can't really have an economic system. You have seen that, and you'll see it further as we discuss the topic. There are definite and better alternatives than interest. Some people might say if you don't take interest, money would be idle and would lose in value. The answer to that, and who said that Islam agrees with the idea of leaving money idle? It's not the idea of investing the money or getting some income on it. It is the question of how you invest that, whether there is sharing in profit and loss or a fixed type of interest. I should add here that even among the rare jurists who might have taken what she called a lenient attitude towards interest, some of them, after they expressed their opinion, they got very strong rebuttal from other learned jurists, and apparently they realized their mistakes and kept quiet. They didn't argue back, which is tantamount of really withdrawing their position. In another case, a relatively more recent case, a person even who published this kind of view, particularly about the investment or saving in the post office, as was done in some countries under the administration of the post office for fixed interest. It was reported also that before his death, he also came back or reversed his position on the topic. So the thing that should be remembered here is that an honest Muslim would not try to cheat some mistake or slip by a jurist and say, oh, haha, you know, this is someone who's learned who said that you can take it. That's not an honest approach. One has to look into the evidence and to the fact that it has been strongly, rejected by the great majority of jurists.
Mm-hmm.
And it is impossible, that God would forbid us something which is absolutely essential for our life. Just like saying God say, don't eat.
Mm-hmm.
No. It's impossible that such a command would exist in Islamic teaching. So when God says, don't take interest or give interest, it is impossible that this command would contradict with the basic survival and needs of human beings. There must be a tendency.
Well, I'm sure many of our viewers who are watching who are accustomed to the system in North America where interest is very, very prevalent must be anxious to hear some of the reasons as to why Islam has prohibited interest. Could you give us some reasons?
First of all, one has to be quite honest by giving the first and most important reason, at least from the Muslim point of view. As you have seen in the previous program, and to some extent in this one, the prohibition of interest in Islam is unequivocal. There is no ifs and buts. It's so clear text. So the Muslim, if God, who knows our needs as humans, and who is revealing this teaching for the overall welfare of the individual and society and the world at large, has forbidden that, there must be an awful good reason, even if we can't find all the reasons. That itself suffices for the believer. But that's not all. First of all, the attitude of taking and giving interest is an activity or behavior which seems to reduce the feelings of compassion and sharing in society and tends to foster the attitude of greed and, in many cases, even exploitation. Well, somebody might say, well, you're really talking about the consumption loans, really, some ethical objection to it. But how about others? Others loans used for production. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with that? There are a number of wrong things with it. First of all, when an economic system is based largely on interest, you'll end up having a few individuals or institutions who have tremendous and disproportionate power in society. These are the ones who control loans, who control, you know, money. And when they control money, some if they were individuals would not really be not motivated to seek some other productive work to benefit society, because they can just sit down and simply because they have some wealth which they inherited or earned or whatever, they can just sit idle and money they get money in their case, which is, should not really be the case. And they get disproportionately rich. And when you get a few individuals like that or institutions, it spills out on the political system. Because again, the so-called, you know, industrial war machinery, industrial complex would really exert a great deal of pressure in the political sense to guarantee the protection of their particular interests. And that could lead also to political corruption.
Yeah.
Secondly, as a principle in Islam, which is both ethical and practical, is a rule in Islamic law called al-ghunmu bil-ghurm, which means that if a person is subjected to the possibility of profit, he should as well be subjected to the possibility of loss. If a person may get large profit, he should also be prepared to accept lower profit depending on the achievement of a particular venture or enterprise. Now, this whole notion, ethical and practical as it may be, is not there in the question of interest. Why? Because when you lend some money, you're guaranteed, you're given certain fixed interest bearing type of document, regardless of what profit the enterprise is making. If they lose, they still have to pay you. If they make more profits, you don't get all the profits, you get part of it and they keep the rest. And that is contrary to Islamic philosophy that people should share equally in the positive and negative, in the profit and loss. The other aspect which relates to one verse we cited from the Quran in chapter 2, verse 275, which likened those who deal in interest or usury as one who touched by devil or by Satan.
Mm-hmm.
The possible translation to that into our modern term is the kind of psychological torment in anxiety that people who deal in interest are subjected to. Ask anyone who has a house, for example, during this last few years, particularly last 1 year or so,
mm-hmm.
when their mortgage was coming up for renewal, how much anxiety about the great impact on the change of interest on their monthly payment. There is anxiety on the one who has to pay interest. There may be also anxiety on one who's taking interest. What's going to happen to interest rate tomorrow? How much will be my income as a result of this? So this attitude, which combines greed and anxiety, is something really which causes a great deal of agony to many people on both sides of the deal. There are some practical reasons also. Many companies go bankrupt because the creditors are not willing to give them a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you lend money, you don't care what will happen to the company.
Mm-hmm.
They may have certain capital, and all you're concerned about is getting back your loan or bond plus the interest that has accumulated. So if a company runs into some difficulty, if you're a shareholder, you wait a little because you're likely to lose your money. If you're a creditor and there is any sign of difficulty, you don't care how much damage will happen to society, you don't care who gets his slip, be unemployed as a result of this, you don't care how much losses the company would incur when they sell their assets, of course, at very, very low price, so long as you're getting your money back, your debt. So this again creates this difficulty and maybe responsible for many cases of bankruptcy of viable enterprises, which, if it will be on equal sharing of profit or loss could have possibly survived and weathered the difficult period that they were going through. Another aspect, when you make loans available, everybody says, right, I can get any loan I want if I'm willing to pay the interest, exorbitant or small as it may be. And that may generate some kind of excess expenditure on the part of consumers. Many people do not behave wisely because they know they can get the loan. And as you know, many economists refer to this fact that some people are up to their ears in debt on all this charge card business and so on, because the ease of getting money might cause people to make many unwise decisions in consumption. Furthermore, when you have a few people controlling wealth, and when they need money, simply they borrow money from others, so other people have no control on the way they run the business, you give again disproportionate power to fewer individuals or fewer institutions and society, and that's not a very quote-unquote democratic type of approach. So the point is that besides all of these difficulties, and this is not an exhaustive list, there are some economists even may have some questions about some negative effects of interest, particularly high interest rates. The idea is that there are definitely better and equitable alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, another argument for interest is that it's not basically different, or it doesn't differ substantially from partnership. Somebody holds that view. How would you respond to that suggestion?
Well, there are two basic differences. You can make analogy. First is that when you give something by way of loan, you have a guarantee, at least, so long as the whole thing does not go under and you lose everything, but basically you have at least guarantee in a sense of that of interest payment on plus your capital or your principal amount that you loan without participating in profit and loss. Whereas in partnership, you equally participate in profit and loss. So if the company makes 20% profit, you get 20%. If they make 5%, you get 5%. They make no profit, you don't get profit. If they make 2% loss, the same thing will happen to you. But that's essentially different from loan. Because in the loan, even if they lose, so long as they still have some capital to pay you, even if they have to sell that capital, they still have to pay you the principal plus the fixed interest promised 7% or 8% or whatever the case may be. That's one basic difference, isn't it? The second basic difference also, it relates to the point I was raising earlier also about the control of the destiny of society. If you lend money, you have no control whatsoever. In other words, the company, it's not your business how we run it.
Mm-hmm.
You just give us the loan, we'll give you the bond, you're entitled to 8%, you have no say as to how the business should be run. If you buy shares, on the other hand, that is a form of partnership, you have the right to be elected to the board or elect qualified people to the board of directors. So in a sense, the person who is sharing profit and loss has some control. So there's some sharing in the decision-making process in society, which is definitely more democratic. You call it industrial democracy, production democracy, whatever you call it, but there's some kind of sharing rather than leaving that power only in a few hands. At least there are larger base in participation in very crucial decisions and the efforts and expertise, and we agree ahead of time that you take certain percentage of the profit, I'll take a certain percentage. There is nothing wrong, again, because the profit or loss is shared by both, and there is some kind of equity in the distribution of income. If this is not possible, some people say, I don't have enough even for this. Well, Islam is not against buying shares, but you have to make sure that it's common stock, not preferred shares where there's some minimum. But if you buy common shares in companies which are not prohibited, like you don't buy shares, for example, in companies making wines or dealing mainly in interest as a basic business, you could buy that, and with the smallest amount, you could possibly be really a partner in that company in this very small capacity. So that's again another thing that you could do. If you say, all right, I want to invest in something which is more liquid, something that I can really get my money back relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, there is the so-called mutual fund or investment bank, where the bank or institution collects money from people who want to invest, and then invest it in lawful investment that Islam allows, and then at the end of the year, you know, sharing in the profits and the various ventures to which the bank has contributed. So they collect the profit, and then they distribute it per capita or per dollar, depending, of course, on how much profit they made, and everybody can get his share. But this allows, again, for entry and exit of different investors. In fact, they, in some countries, cooperatives have also been operating very successfully, especially with farmers, providing them with loans, not really loans, but providing, let's say, with capital needed for production, and then looking after the sales of the production to avoid, again, exorbitant charges by middle persons.
Yes.
And then finally, deduct whatever has been provided to them by way of fees or rental for equipment and so on, and making a modest profit on that. So there are varieties of ways where investment can be made.
Mm-hmm. Well, some claim that interest is perhaps better than the alternative that you suggest, because it gives people who want to invest money a lot more flexibility, different degrees of risk and so on. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to that?
Well, that it may appear so on the surface, but when you look at it closely, really, it doesn't. Because let's take a few examples of this. Suppose you don't want to take any risk at all. Well, there is nothing against Islamic law. For example, if you wanted to keep a few dollars for contingency, either at home or in the bank as a deposit, you know, you could do that. There is no objection. Suppose you want to take only a small degree of risk, but to protect your capital. Well, the answer to that, buy blue chip, buy shares in companies like utilities, which doesn't give that much high return, but at least it, you're not likely to lose your capital, and there might be a modest appreciation also of your capital. You could do that. If you're interested in high degree of risk, plus or minus 25%, that is, you're willing to make a profit of 25% or lose 25%, or else you can buy from a company that is high risk company. If you want a combination, make a mixed portfolio. So for each degree of risk, there is definitely a solution.
Well, we may be able to pursue this a little bit further in our next program. It's great, unfortunately, for this time, we've exhausted our time. We want to thank you for watching. Come back next week, and we'll continue our discussion. As-salamu alaykum. Peace be unto you. Thank you.